What's up, everyone? Lookout Landing Podcast, episode 12. I'm your host, Scott Weber. I'm joined today by Doug Kide and Edgar Martinez. Well, okay, sort of. The Edgar Martinez is the interview that was posted last week. If you didn't get a chance to listen to it then, here's another chance today. It airs at the 37th minute of this podcast, so if you would like to skip ahead, totally understand that. It is Edgar Martinez, after all. Let's get things going. Doug and I talk about a lot of stuff, including Boston and the World Series and Jacoby Ellsbury and baseball cards and hats, and you know how we do. So here we go.
All right. We're joined here by Doug Kide. He's been on the podcast before. He works for NESN in Boston covering the Patriots, but it still counts. Am I right? Still counts.
Still counts. It's still the network that broadcasts the Red Sox. So I watch them. I'm around. I like baseball.
Yes, you do. Okay, let's do a little World Series preview right now. The first thing I'm curious is, how is the feeling in the city right now compared to where it was at in 04, 07, you know, some of these previous years? It's like the pressure's not there anymore like it was before.
Oh, no, definitely not. And I think because of that, people have lost interest a little bit in baseball and the Red Sox. It obviously, people still care, but it's not quite like it was in 2004 or even so much in 2007. I think that's some of that has to do with just the fact that people don't care about baseball in general that much anymore, it seems. I don't know if that's a fact or not, but yeah, people definitely care though. And it's a big deal now that they're in the World Series, but, and even the fact that there were games not selling out as the season was ending, that was a pretty big surprise here in Boston.
Yeah, I think it's a surprise to me too, especially after what happened last year. You know, the big bounce back comeback year, kind of the return to form a little bit. It seems like it just hasn't been as big of a buzz as I'd expected.
Yeah, it's not quite the same as it was, but you know, I think once these games start up, everyone's gonna care a little bit more. People are definitely tweeting about the games. People are definitely tuning in and rigging NESN. I can vouch for that. But yeah, it's definitely a little bit strange. But this is a fun team, and it's obviously they've got exciting players like Xander Bogaerts and a bunch of pretty good pitchers, some fun hitters to watch. So I think that people are going to care, but it's just a little bit odd right now that I think there's just so much going on too. I don't even know.
Are people in Boston also doing the beard thing, like fans?
Not that I've noticed, really. People will show up in like fake beards, and maybe some people are doing it, but it's not like hockey where people will join in on that kind of fun. People just seem to enjoy looking at the beards, but don't exactly want to grow them themselves, I think.
Yeah, as long as we can avoid people growing beards like Mike Karp. does he actually dye that thing yellow? That's my question.
I don't know. It
is the grossest favorite beard I've ever seen.
It's Clay awful. Buchholz's is pretty bad.
this Buchholz, is bad too.
I talked to my girlfriend about this the other day. I was talking to Nick Underhill, the Patriots beat writer for Mass Live, about it on Saturday night. He is the worst outward appearance of pretty much anyone. The like stringy wet hair, the beard that's like blondish, brownish, awful. It's like he's trying to intimidate hitters just by looking as awful as he possibly can. But
yeah, and then he's throwing to Salto Macchia, who's got the absolute worst haircut I've ever seen. I mean, let's be honest. Baseball players are notorious for having really shitty haircuts. That's just something that's existed for a long time. Every time you see a baseball player with the hat off, you're like, good God, what is he doing with that hair?
Yeah,
it's like so greased or balding, or it's just terrible. But Salto Macchia has got that super high hairline and just that almost like Jerry Curl thing going on for a white guy. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty awful. And yeah, some of the beards these guys are growing are pretty rough. But yeah, that's a pretty brutal looking battery there with Buchholz and Salto Macchia.
I love it though. And then you've got Napoli. It looks like someone just dumped their grandmother's urn on his beard, you know?
Oh God, I know. Yeah, he's got that weird. Yeah, it's a fun team though. I mean, Gomes keeps things interesting. Napoli does. Their post game celebrations are pretty out of this world. But no, it's been fun to kind of latch onto. And obviously, I'm paying a lot of attention to football. But it's been nice to just kind of watch games at home at night and everything, and kind of just enjoy it a little bit.
It's I'm rooting for Boston this time. You know, I wrote about it on the site today, and it's just to me versus the Cardinals and everything the Cardinals have done with the whole complaining about celebrating and things like that. I'm so sick of that narrative this year, from everything that happened with the Braves and Brian McCann to the Dodgers and the Mickey Mouse stuff, and then everything that happened. I'm just really sick of it. I like players celebrating. I like players having fun. And even though Boston's certainly not among my favorite teams, and in fact has been in a team that I've disliked actively in the past, I just can't help but feel like this is a pretty fun team to root for.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I mean, Cardinals fans can be a little bit little braggy, best fans in the world, that whole thing, that gets a little bit on my nerves a little bit. So yeah, I can understand that people are probably cheering for this Boston team. Like you said, it's a fun team to root for, and I guess it's a decent Cardinals team too, but they've won so much lately, and obviously Boston has too, that it's probably not that exciting of a World Series for the general populace. But yeah, this Red Sox team should get some people to root for them, I think I'd say.
Yeah, I think you have to kind of look at a postseason matchup where you don't really care about the teams and pick a reason to root to. You know, like I'm not going to be broken up if either one of these teams wins, but I think sometimes the most fun World Series are the ones where you can just really sit back and just watch amazing baseball players go at it on the biggest stage. And that's what this World Series is going to be. I don't care if either team wins it, to be honest, but I know that we're going to see some pretty special, iconic moments in this World Series simply because of who's playing.
Oh, yeah, and it's a fun matchup because these teams have obviously played before in 67, 2004, and I think it was 46 was the other time. And I mean, the fact that David Ortiz is still around and still unbelievably good this amount of years later is – It's crazy. Like I was a freshman in college during the 2004 World Series, and that seems like a lifetime ago. And David Ortiz still looks exactly the same, and he's just as good as he was then. It's pretty crazy, and that's a cool little storyline too, I guess.
Yeah, how's this? 2004, David Ortiz, 28 years old, 145 OPS plus, and now in 2013 at 37 years old, 160 OPS plus.
Wow, he's gotten better as the years have gone on. Yeah,
the OPS was higher in 2004, but obviously a more offensive era relative to the rest of the league. The past 2 years, he's actually had his two of his highest OPS pluses in his entire career. Last year was the highest he'd ever had.
That's insane. I mean, he actually looks in better shape today than he did then. He's kind of lost a little bit of the gut, so maybe that's what's helping him. But I don't know. I mean, he's obviously a really fun player to watch. And just the fact that there is a player there who's still there from that 2004 series, it does bring some people in. It does make it pretty fun for people who maybe even lost interest a little bit over the years.
Sure.
Like myself, I have to admit that, I mean, just the fact that my job is in another sport, I can't watch baseball as much as I used to.
Right. It's really weird to think that Ortiz is the only guy left from 2004, too. I mean, it seems like, I know it's been, you know, this is the 10th season after that, but it seems like there isn't that much turnover in iconic franchises so much. And maybe that's just because, you know, we're used to, you know, Boston and New York had these guys that just played there for so long, with Veritek and Wakefield, and in New York with Mariano Rivera and Jeter and stuff like that. It is kind of weird to think that he's the only one left and he's still the best hitter 10 years later.
Yeah, it's pretty insane. And they've done a pretty good job, I guess, of keeping the core pieces together. Obviously, Lester's been there a long time, Buchholz, Pedroia. But yeah, I mean, that wasn't exactly a young team in 2004. And I mean, even David Ortiz, he wasn't that young in that series, in that season. He was 28 years old, like you said. But yeah, it's definitely interesting. But yeah, just the fact that this is happening after last year when they completely bottomed out, I think that's kind of what they needed. They needed that bottoming out. And I thought that to pick up again, the fans would kind of start to get into it a little bit more. And they have at this point, but it was a little bit disappointing to see that, you know, games weren't selling out and everything. It's not typical for Red Sox fans and for the Red Sox in general.
Yeah, I was definitely surprised to see some of that go on. That was kind of a shock to me. In 2004, you're talking about your freshman in college. I was a junior in college, and I was just thinking and writing about today my memories that I have that are so distinctive of that, and just rooting for Boston so hard because New York was just the absolute enemy. I had kind of hard feelings left over from 2001 still when they knocked the Mariners out. And, you know, New York had won so many championships at that point. I think they'd won 6 of the last 8 or something like that. Yeah. Let's see. They won 96, 97, 98, and then, I don't know. I'd have to look that up. I don't want to misquote that. But they had 2 three-peats, right?
I think so, yeah. They did not win in 2001.
Arizona won 2001. 2002 was Anaheim?
I think so, yeah. And then 2003 was the Marlins.
Yeah. Maybe the three-peat came after then, after that.
Might have, yeah. But obviously there was the... There was a string before that as well that, yeah.
If I do it in reverse, I can usually get all of the winners all the way back to about 1990.
That's pretty impressive.
Let's see here. No, no three-peats. What am I talking about? 2009, that was it. 2000, yeah. 99, 98. And then, 96, that's it. They won and then they, okay. So 97, the Florida Marlins wedged their World Series titles in there somehow. That's yeah. The one that I always miss when I go backwards and talk about World Series winners is the Chicago White Sox in 2005 for recent ones. I just that one for some reason is hard.
It's kind of a lost season for me. I don't know, like the Red Sox were, it was just that post World Series. I don't know. Yeah, that's definitely a weird one. I don't even remember who was on that White Sox team really.
Let's find out.
Yeah, the good thing there's this thing called the internet.
Oh man, all right, let's do a version of the game right now.
Oh god.
I'm not looking. It's here. I can scroll down and see who's on it later. 2005 White Sox. This is hard.
Yeah, this is really hard.
Okay. AJ Pierzynski.
Yes. Oh my god.
Paul Konerko.
Yeah, I was going to say Konerko. Was Konerko on that team?
We're going to find out. I'm not looking yet. there's a potential that we're going to end up looking really stupid on this one.
Yeah. Like Maglio Ordóñez wasn't on that team, was he?
Ooh, Maglio might have been on there. Yeah, that's possible.
Was Podsednik on that team?
Scott Podsednik? Yeah, that sounds right. Definitely Jermaine Dye.
Yeah.
That's in the Jermaine Dye era.
Oh my, who was their infield?
Okay, let's reframe this. Let's think back to MVP Baseball 2005.
I right? know, that's kind of what I'm trying to do.
That's what I'm going back and thinking about who was on. Okay, Juan Uribe.
Yeah.
Juan Uribe, I'm almost positive, played short for them that year.
Who pitched on that team?
I can't think of a single pitcher on that team right now. I honestly can't. I mean, there has to be.
Was
who's the ace? Who's the ace? Oh, Mark Burley.
Oh yeah, that makes sense.
Mark
yeah.
Burley. But who else is in that rotation?
God, I am like completely blanking on that team. And the Red Sox played them in either the ALDS or ALCS that year too. Yeah. I think.
I mean, is Bobby Jenks in the bullpen? No,
he was
too early.
I don't know. What? Yeah, it might be. God, who else was in the outfield? I guess we probably got most of the outfield if Ordóñez was even in there. Ordóñez might have been gone like 5 years before then, for all I know.
Was Frank Thomas still on the White Sox?
I don't think so. I think he might have been on like the A's or something at that point, maybe.
Yeah. Wow, this is exceptionally tough.
Yeah, it is. Because Konerko would probably have been the first baseman, right?
Yeah.
I know Guillen was the manager.
Yeah, Guillen was the manager. Konerko, definitely. Pierzynski, definitely. I'm saying Dye is a definite. I think probably 80% on Scott Podsednik. I like that.
I'm pretty sure on that one.
Definitely on Burley, but I don't know. I can't name a single member of that bullpen. I don't know who was the closer, who was anything.
No. I'm going to cheat. I'm going to look.
Yeah, let's take a look. I'm scrolling down. Oh, Joe Creedy.
Joe Creedy. Wow. Carl Everett. So I was very Everett. Off on
Maglio. Oh, Aaron Rowand. I should have gotten Aaron Rowand. Yeah. No Maglio.
No. Frank Thomas was on that team for a bit.
He was he hurt or something? Yeah, he only played 34 games.
Oh, he batted 219 with a 905 OPS. That's kind of insane.
Yep. Looks like he was just hurt that whole year.
Yeah.
And then he went to Oakland the next year.
Freddie Garcia. I was going to guess that.
John Garland.
Yeah, Contreras.
Contreras and
El Duque.
I don't think I ever would have gotten Contreras and El Duque.
Yeah.
How about Dustin Hermanson for the closer?
I know. And he was pretty damn good, too.
And how about Brandon McCarthy as a spot starter?
Wow.
At 21 years old. How? Oh, there's Bobby Jenks. Yep, Jenks.
Bobby Jenks.
Was on the team.
Demasa Marte. Yeah. That's not an extremely impressive team right there.
No, it's really not. And yet they won 99 games.
I know. Like, out of that entire...
That offense sucks. I mean, look at that offense. That's not a good offense. They've only got three regular hitters with an OPS plus over 100. And one of them is Tadahito Higuchi.
Yeah, that's the most insane part. Was that, like, his only good season in the majors?
30 years old. And no, I mean, yeah, it's like all downhill from there, basically.
Pretty much, yeah. That was his only season with an OPS plus over 100. Wow. So.
59 steals for Scott Pizegna that year.
He's kind of an interesting player. I don't know. It seems like he's been absolutely everywhere at this point. And yeah.
He's that guy that's like, there's an infielder hurt. Let's call Scott Pizegna's agent.
Pretty much.
He can play. I mean, you look at his page. He's played for major leagues. He's played for Seattle, Milwaukee, Chicago, Colorado, Chicago again, Kansas City, Dodgers, and then Boston.
I know. Yeah, that was quite a run last year in Boston.
he's done, though, right? He didn't play this year at all. Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, maybe in like the International League or something, or not an International League, independent leagues or something. But
it's 37. Okay, let's get back on track, because you know we're definitely going to come back and do this and bore people. But the point should probably be to do that later.
Absolutely.
When people feel like they don't have to listen anymore. Oh, hey, if you are listening and you haven't heard my interview with Edgar Martinez yet, that went on the site last week. And what we're going to do is we're going to put that into the podcast here, and then Doug and I are going to talk a little bit about that, simply because I was kind of time restricted to get it out, didn't have time to frame a whole podcast around it because it was for an event that Edgar was doing that weekend. That's why we were doing the interview. So we'll talk about that a little bit later on, so make sure to stick around for that, or skip ahead 20 minutes if you feel like doing that. Let's talk about Jacoby Ellsbury real quick, because I think we've talked about this before, but it's certainly gaining quite a bit of legs. Jacoby Ellsbury and the Mariners connected like crazy. Ken Rosenthal says he thinks that that's where he's going to go. The Mariners are just going to absolutely bust the bank for him, $126 million. What do you think, man?
It's too much. It's way too much. Ellsbury's a good player, obviously, and when he's healthy, he might be worth that, but he's just never really fully healthy, it seems like. This year, obviously, it was a pretty decent year this year for him, but I don't know. I mean, can you really justify spending that much for a guy who's so on and off? Obviously, this was kind of one of his on years, but it was still only a 781 OPS, 52 stolen bases. I mean, I guess he kind of fits the Mariners stadium, maybe fits their plans a little bit. He is a West Coast guy, but I mean, I'd be pretty hesitant to give him that much money. As a Mariners fan, what are your thoughts on that?
I like Jacoby Ellsbury a lot. I think it's kind of crazy to offer him that much money, but I also understand that if you want free agents to come to Seattle in a non-contending team, you're going to have to pay a premium. So yeah. While in a vacuum, I am taken aback by that much money. I would understand if the Mariners did it, and I wouldn't be totally against it. I think the thing with Ellsbury is I always look at the nature of what his injuries are.
Yeah.
And he isn't a guy that has like a bulky elbow or a bad knee, or he's had a bunch of surgeries or hamstring things. He's not Matt Kemp, basically, you know?
Right.
He's a guy that's like just played hard and he's crashed into some dude and he's broken bones. And to me, that doesn't really scream a guy that's necessarily injury prone. It screams a guy that has some sort of combination of bad luck and plus maybe playing a little smarter to avoid stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's why I'm not as scared about his injury history as maybe some other people go. I think speed ages well. I'm more confident about a player whose value is really, built around speed than it is around power or you know, contact and stuff like that. I'm not as concerned about a decline in that regard. I like him. I think he's a good player, and I think the Mariners have a huge hole in the outfield. They absolutely have to go get another outfielder this year. They can't continue on like this. So I think they're going to do it. I think they're going to toss a bunch of money at him, and they're going to outbid everyone else, and I think he's going to come.
I don't think it's going to be the worst thing. I mean, obviously it's a ton of money, but I mean, money is money. It's, if the Mariners want to spend it, they want to spend it. And I don't think they're going to be convincing someone else to come over there with that much money. So, yeah. I mean, he's, like you said, his skills are probably going to age pretty well. Speed doesn't seem to be tailing off at all for him. He is 30. So how many years was the reported deal for?
6 or 7.
I mean, 36, 37 years old at the end of that deal, that could be a bit of a killer, but...
Yeah, he's basically got to age like Kenny Lofton in order for it to be... I mean, you look at the speed guys. Me and Logan, who's one of my writers, he did a tremendous amount of research on kind of aging curves for guys like that. Pretty interesting, you know. Kenny Lofton was the ideal scenario,
you know. Yeah, that's... Yeah.
Then Coco Crisp, I think, is another guy who you could say, okay, he's probably aged pretty well, but...
Definitely.
You know, then you've got guys like Brian Roberts who kind of fell apart. He brought up him as an interesting comp too, and that's also different because he's playing, you know, infield versus outfield, and
changes things obviously.
And I think a lot of Mariners fans are scared because of the Sean Figgins thing, but in reality, there's quite a big difference between.
Yeah, and
that.
you can't be scared to like pay any player just because one was the worst case scenario. I mean, like yeah, that could happen with Jacoby Ellsbury, but. There's not a good chance of that happening. I think his upside, too, is so high. I mean, if he ever approached those, 2011 numbers ever again, that deal would look genius.
Yeah, he's a nine win player in 2011.
Yeah, that's pretty absurd. He was basically like Mike Trout that year, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he had a great year this year, too. I mean, he missed, 30 games, and he's still
about 28 games.
Yeah. 6-win player.
Yeah, good outfielder, and I think there were some whispers that he was kind of a bad teammate one of those years. It was either 2010 or 2012, one of those. But that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. It seems like his teammates really like him.
Yeah,
he gets along with everyone in the clubhouse. He's a good character guy in there at this point. So the only thing that you'll have to convince him to do is just shave that beard because. It doesn't connect to his sideburns, and it kind of scares me a little bit, honestly.
You got to get the connection. Hey, it's not as bad as some of the other ones we've talked about, though, so that's totally fine. At least it's a lot more short and manageable.
Yeah.
The thing that it really, I think, will come down to for Ellsbury is just money more than anything else. You know, I don't think he's going to be a guy that is going to come to Seattle because he's a Northwest guy. I mean... He's from Madras, Oregon, which is not close to Seattle at all. So, I mean, I think that whole thing is kind of ridiculous. It's like you're flying either way, like to go home. And if your family wants to drive up, like Madras is a three and a half, four hour drive. I mean, no one's going to call that close to Seattle. It's very different than like saying, okay, Tim Lincecum, like he might come home. Tim Lincecum lives in Seattle. He owns a place in downtown Seattle. That's where he lives off season. He's from Bellevue. Like Tim Lincecum is a Seattle dude. And if you want to connect that he wants to come back and like hang out with his friends, like that totally makes sense. I totally believe that. And I don't believe that for very many people. I think you actually have to be from that city for it to really matter.
Yeah, I mean, maybe Jacoby Ellsbury has an affinity for pine trees, but that would probably be the only thing that would keep him wanting to live in the Northwest versus, like, Seattle versus Madras, Oregon, or wherever you said he's from. I mean, a four-hour drive isn't any more pleasant than a four-hour flight, so that really doesn't make much of a difference, I don't think, for most players.
I completely agree. Whatever happens with Ellsbury, I'm just excited for the offseason to begin, I think. I'm sure, you know, you are too. It's good. It's always interesting to see how teams react after they make a World Series and what they feel like they kind of have to retool and who they want to keep and if they want to, you know, just start and say, hey, this is a new year. We got to put the best team forward next year. And that's going to include getting rid of some of the current guys we have or whatnot. So And obviously the Mariners, I'm a little bit scared about what they're going to do, because I think, you know, there's this whole thing with Jack Cerenzik. He's kind of fighting for his own job here. And does he value his own job versus, you know, the best interest of the team? That's a little scary, but it's not going to be a boring offseason. I think that much can be assumed.
No, definitely not. And obviously the Red Sox have got some of those guys too. Ellsbury and Napoli are going to be two big decisions for them. Like, I don't really see the Ellsbury as, or the Red Sox as being huge players in Ellsbury, just because they do have Jackie Bradley coming up. They have some other players that they might want to pay. They're going to need to find a first baseman, whether it's Napoli or someone else. So if the contract is getting up that high, I don't really see them being the ones to step in and take him. I think he's probably going to want a lot of money. I don't think he's going to take a hometown discount for the Red Sox, because it won't make any sense. He's already won World Series here.
Yeah.
He's going to win this year, unless he's best friends with the entire team and he can't stand the thought of losing them. I'm pretty sure he's just going to take the highest paycheck.
Yeah, because this is it for him. This is his payday. I mean, I think it's,
oh, yeah.
You're talking about like Tim Lincecum. It's a little different. Lincecum had a he had arbitration deal. He signed that 2-year $40 million contract. Lincecum's made a lot of money. Ellsbury's been year to year the whole way along. This is his crack at a payday.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I just can't see him not taking less than he wants.
Yeah. And he's not a guy like Pedroia, or I guess even Buchholz took a hometown discount. I mean, Pedroia is like the most beloved player in Boston. Ellsbury doesn't really have that stature here. So I don't think that he's going to think, oh, I'm, you know, abandoning the fans or anything, because the fans have been a little bit rough to him here too. I mean, guys definitely got on him for that broken rib thing. I think that was in 2010 when he wouldn't play through the broken ribs. And I was obviously on his side. I mean, you can't swing a bat with broken ribs. People are going to complain if he's struggling while trying to hit with broken ribs. So it really wouldn't have benefited him all to try to do that. But that kind of got fans sour on him a little bit. And anytime that he kind of starts to struggle a little bit, people will jump on him a little bit over here.
Yeah, that's a lose-lose situation for players. It's always an interesting thing to look at.
Oh, yeah. With Buchholz this year, too. I mean, people were despising Buchholz because he wouldn't pitch through his arm issues. And I just felt awful for him basically the entire time, because he obviously couldn't pitch. He's not going to sit out if he can pitch. He's not going to say he can't. It's, I don't know. Baseball fans and injuries are a whole different story.
Yeah. Let's switch gears here for a second, and I want to talk about uniforms with you, because I know you're a uniform nerd. I've seen your name pop up bits on UniWatch over the years.
Yes.
You know, earlier in the offseason here, I kind of talked about the Mariners switching uniforms, and I'm in support of it. I like the current uniforms just fine. I think they're a little tired. It's interesting to watch the Mariners kind of stay the same over the last 20 years while everyone else has kind of changed, at least somewhat. They've at least done different things. You know, Boston added the two Sox hat, and they changed the road uniforms and did, you know, they've done a few things to kind of spruce it up, even though obviously they've kept that classic look all the way through. Well, Seattle has just had, you know, very special events or Sunday alternates. They really haven't introduced a new cap. What are your thoughts on that? I know, you know, you're obviously a Seattle guy. You grew up in Seattle, Mariners fan. You know the blue and yellow well. I know you like the teal. You think it's time for a change?
I mean, I really do like the current uniforms, but if they're going back to blue and yellow, that is kind of honoring history a little bit, and I really wouldn't mind it. I know the thought... What was the rumor that was going to be navy and gold? So navy and yellow.
Yeah, and cream.
Yeah, the cream I can do without. But if they did go kind of with a current design, but changed it to navy and yellow, I wouldn't mind it. I think it would be nice to kind of show their history a little bit. But obviously, I do love the teal. I'm a teal guy. I like the teal alternates. But it might be time for a change. Teams don't change enough sometimes, and I don't think the Mariners are exactly that classic franchise like the Tigers or the Red Sox or the Yankees, who should never be allowed to change their uniforms because they've changed them so much since 1977.
Right.
I think that, you know, every now and again, it's probably time for a change. And the Seahawks have shown that you can be very successful with a change, and that you can be very unsuccessful with a change, as they showed in 2000. So I don't know. I'm for it, I guess. As long as they don't go with the the Sounders or Seahawks colors. I think I'd be cool with it.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's a possibility, though. I honestly do think that's a possibility at some point to kind of do the unified front thing.
Yeah.
I just think you have to look at those other two franchises and the success that they've had and think that it's at the very least a possibility. I mean, I want to see the Trident back. I know a lot of fans don't like the Trident. There's some sort of notion that says it's cursed because the Trident is pointed in the wrong direction or stuff like that, whatever. I think the Trident's the best logo they've ever had. I think it needs to be an updated Trident. It shouldn't be the same one that it was before, but I my favorite hat, I've got this navy Mariners hat. It just has a white Trident. It's an updated Trident logo straight down on it. That's it. It's really simple. And I've always thought that that would just make a really great hat, because I think that's my problem with the compass rose and the S is I just think it's a little noisy, to be honest with you. I think it's a little bit complicated for a baseball logo.
It is. I agree with that. And I mean, I don't know how much a compass really has to do with Mariners. It's kind of a distant relative of it. And yeah, I like the Trident. The Trident's a good logo. That was always, I mean, I always even liked like the plain S. I think the Mariners have always had good uniforms. And as long as they keep that up, that I kind of trust them. But I don't know about the whole unified front thing with like the Seahawks and Sounders. It's like, obviously those teams have had success, but imagining a baseball team with neon green accents is something that my brain doesn't even really register. I can't actually picture that. I mean, I guess it would be kind of interesting, but I don't know. The navy blue and yellow sounds fine. The cream, though, I've never been a fan.
Yeah, I don't like the cream at all. I think if they ever did do the rave green, is what we call it here, it would be in an accent kind of way. But I think it's just odd for baseball. Like I said, I think there's a chance of it, but I think it's an odd choice for a baseball team. It's just very Miami. That's all I would think about. It's just too kind of like flamboyant for baseball. Here I am speaking all old school about baseball, about how much, and then earlier I'm talking about how much I hate all the old school crap like that. But
it is a weird thing. I mean, maybe baseball does need to get more modern. Maybe they do need to throw in some neon green accents, because I don't know, the baseball generation, obviously, other than people like ourselves, is dying off to some degree. And I my mom works in schools, and she says that those kids don't care about the Red Sox at all. And that's kind of scary that there are kids in high school who don't even follow the Red Sox.
Yeah.
It's kind of strange.
It's a cultural thing. And I think that hats are part of a changing culture now, where it's about fashion more than it's about fandom. I think the kind of the snapback thing has revitalized that. And now we have rumors that there's going to be new hats in 2014, that new era is going to. So I have you read about this on UniWatch? I can't remember exactly what it is, but New Era's exclusive contract expires at the end of next year or something like that. And the new hats may have another fabric. They may be the kind of perforated ones, like the batting practice hats.
Huh. Interesting. No, I haven't really read up on that.
Here it is. I pulled it up on UniWatch, and it said, I've been told that all MLB hats will be switched to the Diamond Era batting practice cap material next season, and that the current Authentic Collection caps will be discontinued.
Wow.
New Era's exclusive contract is set to expire at the end of 2014. MLB is less than pleased with New Era for snagging the rights to the NFL and creating a product line that is in direct competition with Major League Baseball's on-field line, and as such has been slow to re-up with New Era. Nike has thus become interested in acquiring the contract and has become a full court press to become MLB's exclusive supplier of on-field hats.
That would be awful, I think.
I hate the way that Nike hats fit, first of all.
That would be pretty brutal. I mean, New Era has been a part of baseball for ever, it seems like.
Forever.
Yeah, that would be I don't know. I mean, I'm assuming that Nike would probably want to throw a swoosh on all the hats too. Yep. That'd be kind of odd. That'd be kind of weird, but I don't know. I mean, that's kind of mind-boggling to even think about New Era not being a part of it.
Well, I hate that Diamond Era material too.
Yeah, I've never had a hat with that. Yeah, it doesn't look good. It looks kind of odd and a little too textured. personally. But I mean, didn't they just come out with new fabric of the hats?
Yeah, like, a couple of years ago, switching from wool to the whatever it is now, poly, all weather, whatever.
Right, exactly.
The hats that never wear in.
Yeah, pretty much.
I'm holding on to all my old wool hats because those are the ones that really form down to your head, and those other ones, they never really did. They always stayed a little bit more boxy. I never liked them quite as much.
Yeah, even when they get wet, it's like it just turns kind of weird when it tries to form to your head. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, talk about wearing in your hats in the old days. I mean, you used to be able to just stick it under the sink and let it run and then just wear it wet for 20 minutes. Or, well, you know, sometimes I would dunk it and put it on put it on my head, and then you take a blow dryer and put it on hot, and you just blow dry your head with the hat on it, and the wool would just, you know, kind of shunk right in to your head. And that's how I would form all my hats. And then when I tried to do out the new poly material, and it just never worked.
No, yeah, they don't even really get wet that easily. You dunk them in water and it stays away from it almost. Yeah, it is kind of odd.
I miss the wool hats, man. I miss all the stuff that they used to do with hats. You know, I like that Twisted series that they did back in the day when you could buy teams' logos and like other teams' colors and stuff like that.
Yeah, that was cool, actually.
I thought that was a super cool, you know, campaign. So if you wanted to get one city's cap in another one of their professional cities' colors, you know, you could do that.
Yeah.
In another sport or something like that. Like, say you wanted a Kansas City hat, but you wanted it in yellow and red for the Chiefs, you could do that. That was kind of before New Era took over all the NFL stuff, so you could kind of go cross back and forth and do some stuff like that. I have a Twisted hat that's a Washington Nationals that's in UW colors. I think it's super cool.
That's awesome. That's really awesome. Speaking of which, that was a pretty brutal loss.
Yeah, I didn't watch that one.
I didn't either, fortunately.
We were getting back, my wife and I were getting back from something, and I just saw the score, and they were already down, I think, 21-6 or something, and I just said, yeah, that one's not going to end well, so I'm rather, I'd do something else with my Saturday, so.
Yeah.
Okay, let's switch it up, and let's talk about Edgar Martinez a little bit, because I was fortunate enough to be able to interview him last week, and the interview has been on the site, and if you haven't heard it, we'll play it for you in just a second. You can kind of hear my conversation with Edgar. He had some interesting things to say. So let's just take a second right here and play the interview from Edgar, and then we'll come back and talk about it.
Hey, everyone. It's Scott Weber from Lookout Landing, and we're joined today by Mariners icon and legend Edgar Martinez. Appreciate you giving us a call today, Edgar. And you can meet Edgar this weekend. He's going to be at the grand opening of the new Dick's Sporting Goods in Grand Ridge Plaza out in Issaquah this Saturday from 12:30 to 2. So why don't you stop on by and meet a Mariners legend. Do you want to tell us about that a little bit, Edgar?
Yeah, this is an appointment. It's a grand opening for Dick's store. And yeah, I'm going to be there for an hour and a half meeting some of the fans that come over, and I will be signing. So from 12:30 to 2 o'clock, I believe. Yeah.
Great. Hey, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about the manager situation in Seattle while I got you. I don't know if you heard, but the Mariners actually reached out to Lou Piniella yesterday, try and get him to come back, but he seems cool with retirement. What do you think about that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it would be a great it would be great to have him come back. You know, he was a great part of the success that we had in the 90s. You know, he basically helped turn the franchise around. So, but it's too bad that he, you know, he's just didn't want to come back to be a manager.
Another guy that you know that is get talked about a lot for the Mariners is Joey Cora. What do you think about Joey as a manager, based on kind of your time with him, playing with him?
Yeah, you know, Joey is a baseball guy. He's he has a great knowledge for the game. He has spent a few years receivers in Chicago with Archie Dean, and they won the championship. He knows how to win, and I think it would be good for the organization, the fans. Joey, I think he will be a great fit. He will gain the respect of the players, and I think it will be a great fit.
Well, clearly the Mariners are interested in at least a few people who've been a part of the team's success in the past. Are there any other former teammates of yours who you think would make a good coach or would want to come back as a coach? And does that include you? Have the Mariners ever reached out to you for a position like that?
No, they haven't reached to me, and I don't know if they have reached to any other ex-players. But, I mean, it's a number of guys that could be great managers. And one that comes to mind is Ben Wilson, but he's catchers they know features and they know the game very well. Ben is a pretty smart guy, and but I don't know if he will be interested in a position like that. But that's one guy that comes to mind.
Okay. Hey, let's talk a little bit about the fences being moved in at Safeco. You know, this was the first year the fences were moved in, and obviously it was good for some of the young hitters, and we got Edgar's Cantina as part of it, which was nice. I'm interested to kind of get your take on when the Mariners moved into Safeco originally, what kind of impact that had on you and your teammates as a hitter, and what kind of barriers there were to hitting in a pitcher's park when coming from a place that was so hard or so easy to hit in the Kingdome.
One of the things is when you play in the Kingdome, you have the afterbirth, you have the, it's only 70 degrees, you don't have wind, and you don't have glare, and you don't have all these elements that on the north end field you get at times, and at some times it can affect hitters. I think the Safeco field, obviously, we hit better in the Kingdome, but you can build a team that can play 72 games in Safeco field, that can be a good team, good hitting ballpark. I mean, you need the speed, you need the left-handers, hitters, and a couple of guys that have good power. And if you make a team with defense and pitching, depth in pitching, you just need guys that they put the ball in play, they play the game from the man point sound, they move the runners, they bunt, you need players that get on base. You don't have to get on base like a hit. You just have to work the count.
Right.
Work the count, make that pitcher work. And at the end, when you come to the second and third at bat, that pitcher has to work a lot more than you can get to him. But if you get, players that strike out a lot, that they, they swing at the first pitch all the time, that's not, in my opinion, the
matter of. Okay. I'm kind of interested. I don't know if you've heard a little bit. They've been talking about it a lot on MLB Network and things like that. But Joey Votto, who plays for the Reds this year, has kind of come under some criticism for, they say, being too selective at the plate, walking too much, and maybe not driving in enough runs. Is that a criticism that you ever heard in your career, especially in those years when you were walking over 100 times a year, that you should be more aggressive? What do you think about that?
Well, some coaches and some scouts, and they have the style that you have to be more aggressive. My style was completely opposite. I was aggressive when I felt that I needed to be aggressive. But I felt that I started a pitcher enough that I have an idea what they want to do, and And I don't want to be aggressive in situations when I know that pitcher is going to kind of pitch around me, or he's going to start with a slider, or he's going to throw a changer. I want to be aggressive when I feel, I feel good about this guy's going to just come with a fastball in the middle of the plate if he wants to get ahead. You know, knowing the game, knowing situations, the players, you know, we'll be aggressive when we have to be aggressive. But I don't think that, you know, players always have to be aggressive. Working the count, making that pitcher work, help the team, and that's what you want. A lot of guys that do that.
Right. It's interesting how over the past few years, you know, we've seen offense really trend down in the major leagues, especially from when you were playing the game, you know, in the last 10 years. And I think a lot of that obviously has to do with performance enhancing drugs being taken out of the game. But are there any other things that you think attribute to the fact that offense is so much lower than it was in the late 90s and early 2000s?
Yeah, today the players come from the minor leagues with 3 years of experience. They're growing in the big leagues. You know, in those 30 years, players have been in the minors 5, 7 years. I have been 7 years in the minors. I meant to go through my ups and downs in the minors. So when I came to the big leagues, I have confidence that I could play and I could, you know, my ups and downs in the big leagues were, you know, barely, and they were shorter compared to some of these guys that, you know, they go and play in the minors 2, 3 years, they're in the big leagues. I think he's around the league, it's happened quite a bit.
Do you think that the Mariners, who have quite a bit of young talent that they rushed up, Mike Zunino was in the when it was in the minors for a year, do you think that they should be giving some of these guys more time in the minors to really perfect things before they come up?
Yeah, I'm not going to talk about what the minors do. I mean, I talk about the whole league.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what you see, the difference today, it's today they come early to the majors, and sometimes they go through the ups and downs, and the learning becomes in the big leagues instead of the minors.
Right. Hey, I got one final question for you, and I'll let you go. This is one that our readers asked a couple times that they'd like to see asked. Everyone wants to know, what happened to the light bat from that Eagle Hardware commercial?
I don't know where that bat is. I thought that I, you know, I had one in my house, and I moved, and I don't know where it went, so I really don't know.
Well, you had it for a while at least, right?
Yeah, I had one, yeah.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for giving us the time to talk today, Edgar. And once again, you can go meet Edgar yourself at the Dick's Sporting Goods Grand Opening in Grand Ridge Plaza out in Issaquah. He'll be there at 12:30 tomorrow. And we really appreciate it, Edgar. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay, there it is. That's my conversation with Edgar Martinez. What a guy. What a nice guy. Calling me up, you know, a lot of times I think when you do interviews like that, I've done a couple others, and you know, someone says he's gonna call you at this time, and you go okay, and then they, you know, you pick up the phone and you say hey, and they go hey, are you ready to talk to so and so?
Yeah,
and I'm like yeah, okay, and then they do them and they say and they get on the phone, okay, that's fine. I was like hey, I was like hello. Hey, it's Edgar Martinez.
Yeah.
Edgar Martinez. I think he's calling me from his own phone, just I think it sounded like he was driving somewhere. So,
you've got Edgar's phone number now, I guess. So
I do.
That's a nice perk.
Say that. Interesting things. For me, the first interesting thing we talked about was obviously that he thought that Dan Wilson would make a great manager, that Joey Cora would make a great manager. He knows those guys super well. Cora, I don't know if that's going to happen simply because I think it's a weird position to be the Mariners manager this year, you know, where you've got the general manager who's on a 1-year contract, and generally a new general manager that comes in would like to bring his own manager in. So it doesn't seem like it's an ideal situation for a manager to come into an already losing team and then have to worry about your job a year later. So I don't know if Cora is going to work, but kind of interesting to hear the Dan Wilson thing and him talk about catchers being great managers. You think about all of the catchers that have become managers. There's so many of them.
Yeah, there really are. And I don't know. The Cora thing would be kind of interesting. It seems like it's only a matter of time before he gets his first opportunity as a manager.
Yeah.
And if he is viewed as kind of a highly sought after guy, and if he knows that he is, then maybe he is a guy who can kind of withstand separate general managers going from, you know, Jack Z to whoever might take over next. But I mean, yeah, either one of those would be cool. I think that if anything, the Mariners should possibly try to get someone who has a little bit of history with the team, try to get everyone back into it, you know, harken back to 95, 2001.
Oh, they love that.
Yeah, I think that that's probably what they should possibly try to do. And do you think the Mariners in 2014 are going to be a competitive team?
No.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of a loaded question in itself.
I guess we have to wait and see how crazy they're going to get. Now, there's certainly a chance that they could Kansas City Royals it and like sort of put themselves into the conversation of being in contention by making some trades and, you know, going out and getting a guy like Jacoby Ellsbury. They can bring themselves into a 80 to 86 win range, but yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I mean, it is an interesting team. If everything kind of bounces right, then they could be okay, and if the pitching and everything, but I mean, yeah, it's probably not going to be the best situation for any manager to step into, but yeah, getting one of those guys with you know, history with the team, I think it would probably make sense, but I don't know. What is Dan Wilson even really up to these days?
Dan Wilson lives in the area. He shows up on some of the Mariners broadcasts, and he's been in the broadcast booth. You know, honestly, a lot of people have also talked about Mike Blowers maybe being a good manager.
Yeah.
For his knowledge and that he drops in the booth, if you will. But I think, honestly, it's like I have said before, I think that the candidate is most likely going to come from within for this year just because of the weird situation and things like that. But
does that mean Robbie Thompson?
Could be Robbie Thompson. Could be Darren Brown, who was Tacoma's manager, and then he was back up with Seattle and doing some other things this year. So he did interim managing for the Mariners before. And then we've also heard a couple other guys. Chip Hale has been tossed around a lot.
Yeah.
Who is with the A's right now. So we'll see what happens. I'm not going to worry about it. I always say that a good manager is the guy that pisses you off the least.
Yeah.
And they can never win or do anything right. So
no.
That's just how it is. It was funny to talk to him about Pinella a little bit. Because during that time when I did the interview, it was of the thought that the Mariners had reached out to Pinella to offer him the job, which ended up being a bit of an exaggeration. And some of it got lost in translation. It seemed like it was more of a call about some more general things, the way they contacted each other. But that, I guess that really painted into the whole, you know, narrative of let's go back to 1995 in the biggest possible way. Let's go get the 70-year-old manager from it. But that ended up being not true.
No, definitely not.
The other big thing I loved about that interview that we talked about was just how he said, you know, offense is down. Obviously, taking PEDs out of the game and testing and stuff, that I mentioned that. That's been huge, getting numbers down. That's the biggest reason. But I think that there's more to it than that. And his answer saying that people just don't spend as much time in the minors now. They take their lumps in the majors instead of taking them in the minors was super interesting. You know, it's one of the things that's keeping Edgar Martinez out of the Hall of Fame is that the Mariners stuck him in the minors for 7 years. He didn't become a full-time player until he was 27.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to hear him talk about that's something why he thinks offense is down. And if he'd gone through that, if he had gone through his lumps in the majors and had some subpar years, he probably would be in the Hall of Fame because his counting stats would be higher, which is really a ridiculous thing about the Hall of Fame. I hate counting stats. I think they're so stupid. And I don't think players that are in the decline of their careers, they're terrible the last 5 years of their career, they're terrible in the first 5 years of their career. They don't, you know, and they just play forever. They just become overrated. Like Craig Biggio, you know, I think Craig Biggio is overrated because he had a prime and then he's kind of mediocre on both ends of it.
Yeah.
If Edgar had done 4 years of what, you know, whatever production, even if it was a 750, 800 OPS, you know, playing 120 games a year, he'd be in the Hall probably.
Yeah. I mean, with those extra years, if it hadn't taken him so long to get up, he could be right around that 3,000 hit mark, and yeah, probably would have benefited him a little bit. But, and honestly, I mean, just looking at his minor league stats, he probably could have come up earlier. He even kind of got a late start, it seems like, into the minors. But
yeah
I mean, especially with just going back to the Red Sox with that, I mean, Xander Bogaerts came up extremely quickly, and he's a guy who's worked out, whereas other guys like Jackie Bradley Jr. didn't work out so well, and even Will Middlebrooks, it seems like he did very well last year. Then this year, it seemed like there was some more adjusting they probably should have had to do at the minor league level, because he really did kind of struggle a little bit. But it's a player-to-player thing, and I think some guys definitely do benefit more from being down in the minors for longer, but there is a part of me that gets kind of bummed out when guys are in the minor leagues until they're 24 or 25 years old, because you kind of feel like you're missing some of their prime or some of those exciting moments that aren't being shared with the major leagues. Like even Dustin Pedroia, I mean, he wasn't down in the minors for very long, but yeah, he was what, 24, 25, something like that when he came up, and same with Ellsbury, all these guys. And then it seems like they just get old so quickly as well. But
yeah. Especially college players like Pedroia, you know, you come out and you get through the minors and it's like, boom, by the time you're a rookie, you're already in the first year of your prime, really, as far as an aging curve goes, when you compare it to a guy who came out of high school. Yeah. So and I think that's why teams don't want to waste that much time.
Speaking of that for a second, I was actually just talking to one of my friends about John Allred, obviously one of the most famous players who never played in the minor leagues.
Mm-hmm.
He had a fascinating career in that Cito Gaston told him to stop walking, and it basically ruined his career. I don't know if you've ever looked at John Allred's statistics like extensively, but after his insane season, he completely stopped walking, and he was never really the same player again.
Really?
And then I read up on it, and apparently Cito Gaston said that he wasn't being aggressive enough at the plate, and they wanted him to start walking less. And then they eventually traded him, and he kind of picked back up when he was with the Mets and the Mariners. But yeah, I mean, that 1993 season is one of the most ridiculous really around at that time. 1.072 OPS, 114 walks, and then went down to 61 walks the next season.
And third in the MVP voting that year.
Yep, third.
Behind Paul Molitor, which is a joke.
Yeah.
And behind Frank Thomas, who also wasn't quite as good at the plate. I mean,
no. Allred, that 93 season is insane. And I mean, the fact that in 1999 he had even more walks, he had 125 walks, that's pretty absurd as well. Yeah. For a guy who really wasn't thought of as that great of a power hitter. But yeah, getting off John Allred, I guess, but
How weird is it that they had MVPs in 1994, but they didn't have a World Series?
That is very strange. Yeah.
That's super weird. Frank Thomas won the MVP in 93 and 94.
Wow. That kind of changes the scope of his career a little bit.
Yeah, Griffey finished second. Yeah. 729 slugging for Frank Thomas in 1994.
He was a special player.
I mean, talk about wanting to get players up in their prime. Frank Thomas, that's a guy who was up early at 23. He was third in the MVP in 1991. That's
crazy. Exactly. I mean, you never know what's going to happen when these guys come up. And like I said, with Xander Bogaerts, he's kind of like a Red Sox savior right now, filling in for Middlebrooks, might get some at-bats for Stephen Drew. And that's a huge boost to the lineup. And if they don't bring him up, then really what happens this season? What happens this postseason? And it really is fun to watch those 20-year-old guys, but I obviously do kind of understand what Edgar's saying about getting your lumps in the minor leagues, and once you get to the majors, the hitting might improve, but I don't know if it's as exciting of a brand if you aren't cheering for these Mike Trout guys or these Xander Bogaerts guys.
Yeah, everyone wants to hit a home run with their prospects. Now, I think when you see a Mike Trout, everybody, I can't believe I did that. I hate that so much. I hate when you see a Mike Trout. Mike Trout's one person. I apologize to myself and to everyone for doing that, because it bothers the hell out of me when people do that, and I'm sorry.
I'm sure I do it all the time.
When you see Mike Trout be as successful as he's been, everyone thinks, well, maybe we can bring up a prospect and he'll be as successful as that. Well, obviously that hasn't happened. And then on the Mariners, I think they see it. That was what was interesting too, is maybe I put him on the spot a little bit when he talked about guys getting rushed up to the minors a little bit. I was like, well, hey, the Mariners did that a lot this year. You know, I mean, with Zunino and stuff, do you think it's doing too fast? And he was quick to say, Okay, well, I'm not just talking about the Mariners. I'm talking about league wide. But yeah. I think you can kind of put two and two together there to see that might be an issue that he thought was going on with the team right now. And obviously, the results would agree. So.
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of what I think makes the Mariners interesting, though, at least for this upcoming season. Just to see as Zunino and Franklin and Seager and Ackley and Miller and how all these guys progress, and if they're able to progress, if they're able to, have those solid off seasons or whatever the hell happens to get guys to the next level. And obviously, if all of those pieces fall in place, the Mariners could be pretty dangerous next year, but that's a lot of those Peter Gammons if scenarios for all of that to kind of have to happen.
Yeah, that's what makes them the eternal tease.
Yeah.
Hope is going to come back. I look at the Mariners 2014, it doesn't look like it's the most, enticing future, and it doesn't seem like all this stuff. But then you think, hey, if everyone comes back to doing everything the right way, well, yeah, things could happen.
It's funny, the last time we talked, one of the things I asked you is if any of the Mariners would finish with an OPS over 800. And at the time, it looked like Kyle Seager, maybe some of these other guys, had a chance to do it, and not a single one did.
Instead it was Raul Labañez.
Nope, 793.
793, finished under.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
It's, Nobody finished over?
No, Carlos Peguero with 7 plate appearances.
Can we just talk about the Carlos Peguero wire fraud thing? That is insane. I mean, that is one of the weirdest stories.
He's got to know about that, right? He has to. He knows he's not that rich.
This is my favorite thing of the whole thing, right? Is that it says that Peguero's wife asked Felix's wife if she reviewed her debit card statements.
Yeah.
Like, that is hysterical. Don't tell somebody. Alert somebody to that, because what's the best case scenario? They say no, and then they go, oh, I should probably do that, and then find out that someone spent $180,000 at Saks Fifth Avenue on your card.
Yeah. Hey, Scott, this is just an out of the blue question, but do you review your bank statements at all? No. Why?
No, I definitely don't.
Yeah, I mean,
because I didn't spend this $400 at Homage last week, and it seems like you might have done that.
I mean, I can kind of see how Felix and his wife might have overlooked it and been like, oh, well, we're spending a lot of money. Maybe we should stop doing that. Or maybe not even thought that because they're so rich anyway.
Right.
And Felix is my age. Like, I'm still pretty immature. I'm sure to a certain degree, Felix might be a little bit immature, maybe his wife. So, like, I don't know. I mean, I don't obsessively check my bank statement. So maybe Carlos Peguero's wife is also stealing money from me. But yeah, that was a very odd, very, very odd story.
Super, super weird. And Peguero's got to be done in the organization, to be honest. I know that this thing doesn't really come with perhaps his knowledge. Maybe he didn't know. I mean, he probably knew, but maybe he didn't know. But here's the deal. There's going to be a rift between him and Felix if they're in the locker room together. Peguero's 27, or going to be 27. He's not any good. He just came off a bad year at AAA. He's out of options. He's on the 40-man roster. That's a guy who's going to get, knocked out when they acquire someone else to put on the 40-man. Peguero's going to be a casualty. There's no question he's going to be a casualty this offseason.
I look forward to him being the fifth outfielder in Boston next year, and he'll have a 1.1 OPS.
Why you got to do that? Why you got to do that?
I'm just saying.
He probably will.
I look forward to it.
Nah, I honestly think Peguero needs to go to Japan, man. I mean, he's just the exact – he's actually a very similar hitter to Ballantyne, who is now, 60 homers in Japan this year. They're similar kind of insane raw power hackers. And obviously, Peguero's left-handed, but I say he should go do it because he could probably make a couple million bucks over there. And he's not going to make it here.
He's already living in a different country as it is. So what's really the big difference between moving to another different country? I mean, for those guys,
I think there's probably a small difference
between
Tacoma, Washington, and Tokyo, Japan.
I'm just saying that it's not like a guy who's from I don't know. Like, it is a different country. I think there's some adjustments to be made when you come from DR to move to America.
Right.
You know? But yeah, yeah. There's a pretty big difference there.
Yeah. Can you imagine being Carlos Figuero just walking around in Japan?
I mean,
that would be even weirder than, you know, Randy Messenger is walking around in Japan right now pitching. And it's like, okay, well, he's just like a regular American dude. And then you've got Carlos Figuero, who's just a tank. I mean, that guy is a beast of a man. It's like every time I think about Tracy McGrady playing basketball in China or wherever.
Oh, seriously.
Wherever he's been playing basketball. I just think about that and I just laugh hysterically.
Oh, yeah. Did Ballantyne break the record, by the way? I should know that.
He did.
He did. Wow, they let him do it. Jeez.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing, actually.
Yeah, I think he finished with 60 home runs. What was the record? 55 or 56? I think he finished with 60 homers. I can check it on the old baseball reference point right now.
There's so many guys in the Seattle organization like Figuero who just seem to stick around for so long.
Yeah.
And never, you know, they're never really going to make it. I don't know. Like, I guess a guy like Michael Saunders that was happening to him for a while, and he did become a starter, become a decent player in there. But it just seems like there's so many of those guys every year with them.
I definitely agree. We had guys that stuck around for a really long time, Jeff Clement and Jeremy Reed, and guys that just never put it together, and then they eventually move on to another organization. That is so weird to me. As I talk about this a lot, it's one of the weirdest phenomenons to me. And actually, this is maybe something that I should have asked Edgar, is what happens to players that are just killing it in the minors, and then they come up to the bigs, and they can't get it done, and they go back down, and their careers go in the toilet before their prime even happens. Look at what happened to Brandon Wood. Look what happened to Jeff Clement. Why does that happen? These guys dominate when they're 22, 23 years old in the minors, and then they get called up for a season or two. They can't do it. They go back down at 25. It's like a confidence thing.
It's got to be a confidence thing. I think
very odd.
Yeah, that more than anything else. Obviously, the sabermetric community gets accused of thinking the players are robots every once in a while.
Yeah.
And that is kind of it's an eye-opening thing. It's like, obviously, if these players if there was no emotional involvement, if everything were on a, AB scale or whatever, then they wouldn't go back down to the minors and struggle and tank their careers in that instance.
Right.
They would just be able to go back and hit exactly as they were before. But yeah, I think it definitely is a confidence thing, or maybe they just kind of lose faith a little bit. They know that they might not be able to make it in the majors, and then they don't care as much.
You work so hard to get to that one point, and then you get there, and it's not what you'd always envisioned. So then working back to get to that point again isn't quite as glamorous as the first time you kind of dreamt about it.
Yeah, and it's such an uphill climb at that point, too. It's like, wow, I have to do this all over again.
Yeah, and then the organization already has someone else that they say, well, here's a contingency plan because this prospect might not work out. And then you got someone else to beat to get back up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, hopefully that kind of stuff doesn't happen to someone like, Will Middlebrooks or some of these guys who have kind of struggled, like Jackie Bradley in the Red Sox this year. But I mean, there's always that fear when you do have to send a guy back that the confidence is going to get shot, or that they just kind of lose faith a little bit. And yeah, it's kind of a scary thing.
Well, I think we see something sort of like that going on with Dustin Ackley, except when Dustin Ackley went back down, he actually really dominated. But the thing with Ackley is that Ackley has a skill set to dominate the minor leagues. It's not going to be a problem for him. He's got to make the adjustments to dominate in the majors. Or he doesn't have to dominate. He just has to be good.
Yeah. How do you see his career playing out? Obviously, that's another pretty loaded question. But
At some point, I think you just kind of have to say, now it's up to the player.
Yeah.
He showed he can make – we know he has the talent to be a very good major league player. He's a good defender at second base. When he's hot, he's a guy that can easily hit 280 and slug 380 and, or on-base percentage of 370 and slug 430, 800 OPS guy. I think that's Dustin Ackley where he could really settle in.
Yeah.
But it's all about whether he can make the adjustments or not. When he came back up from the minors, he struggled for a little bit, and then all of a sudden he was making the adjustments, and he was swinging at everything, and he wasn't letting pitchers get away with that outside strike on him anymore. He was swinging at it. He was driving balls opposite way up the line, and then pitchers started to come back in, and then he started ripping stuff again, and then he lost it again, and he started to get manipulated at the plate again. So it's up to him. I would love to say that I know what's going to happen with Dustin Ackley, but I just don't have any idea which direction he's going to go.
In Seattle, what's the common thought as to which one of those guys is going to be the best major leaguer out of Franklin, Seager, Ackley, and Miller?
It's a very what have you done for me lately city.
Yeah.
Unless we're talking about 1995. Right. So I think that people like Franklin and Miller right now because they think they're the new battery because they're the guys that were up. And Franklin, even though he struggled quite a bit down the stretch, I think most of the casual fans would say that he's the guy at second base, and then Ackley just has to, you know, figure something out. Mm-hmm. I think the Lookout Landing community still likes Ackley a lot and likes the pedigree and likes the approach and thinks that he can be a solid player. Whereas Nick Franklin, obviously, now Franklin's got to go through the same thing that Ackley went through.
Yeah.
Franklin started pulling off that front foot and doing all that stuff that got Ackley into trouble, trying to pull everything when he was hitting from the left-hand side of the plate, and it got him into trouble. So now he's going to have to make the same adjustments that Ackley did and hope that he doesn't have as terrible of a year as Ackley had in 2012.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I mean, those are really the interesting guys in there, but yeah, who the hell knows? Like you said, you can't tell me what's going to happen with them. It's a weird system in there. Like,
right.
All four of them could hit, and none of them could hit. It's odd. I mean, I guess Seager kind of is who he is. So.
Yeah, Seager was having a great year, and then he really kind of toiled off at the end there, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But he's still a 4-win player and a guy they should lock up long term, but I don't know if they'll do it.
Yeah, seriously.
I have in front of me for our final thing of the podcast, it's a pack of 1992 Fleer.
Nice.
Unopened, 17 trading cards, features Fleer All-Stars Provisions trademark, art cards, superstar specials, and more.
Wow. Collect
Roger Clemens career highlights, a limited edition series, details on the back, and you have to send in $1 check or money order with your name and address by October 31st, 1992 in order to get the prize. So I think that we missed a deadline on that a little bit.
But yeah, I don't think you're going to get it.
Let's open it up.
Sounds good.
And we're going to name it off, and then we're going to try and name as many people from a roster as we can based on one of these cards.
Nice.
For one final time. And the top card is a Mariners Omar Vizquel.
Ooh. That's a...
Look at that.
It's a good pull.
Steve Farr. Steve Farr and his palm ball. If you've seen Little Big League, you know that that means double play. Billy Haywood will tell you what's up.
Absolutely.
Tim Tufel. Padres. Wow.
No.
Jose Bautista and not the good one.
No.
Reggie Jefferson. How about a Braves Lonnie Smith?
Ooh, nice. Was Reggie Jefferson Indians in that one?
Reggie Jefferson Indians, indeed. Oh. Yep. Oh. We got Steve Decker, Giants catcher. Don't know who that is.
Yeah.
How about a David Segee?
Ooh.
92 Orioles.
Orioles, wow. I probably would have guessed Expos.
Yeah, that's...
I was talking about David Segee yesterday. He was, even when I was 10 years old and I saw his forearms, that's when I kind of started to figure out that something might be up with the whole steroid thing. His forearms were the size of most people's thighs, I feel like.
Yeah.
And it was like, wow, that guy's really jacked for a baseball player. Like, I wonder why that is. But, yeah.
Yeah, Segee was when the warning flags went off for the first time.
Yeah.
How about this? Dodgers pitcher... Debuted in 1983, John Candelaria.
Ooh, nice. Nice.
We've got Hensley Mullins, Yankees.
Yep.
Fred McGriff, Padres.
Padres? So he got traded in 93 to the Braves? Or signed there?
Yeah, I think 93 was the first year of the Braves.
Oh.
Must be.
Yep.
It was all Blue Jays up until Padres. Jack Clark. There you go. Red Sox, Jack Clark.
Nice.
Chris Sabo.
The my best.
Man, Chris Sabo, Spuds. Pointed out by my friend and writer Patrick Dubuque that he stole, how many? He stole 46 bases in his rookie year.
Oh my God.
Chris Sabo, not known for being a base stealer, 46 bases in his rookie year. The next year, 14, then 25, and then 19.
Wow. That's
pretty impressive.
That's pretty impressive, definitely.
Whatever happened to these batters that just, like, they never struck out and they never walked? You know?
Yeah.
Guys like Kenji Jojima did that. And you go back and you look at Kenji Jojima's numbers, and it just blows your mind. I got to pull them up right now. You won't even believe that this could happen in a league now where everybody strikes out so much.
Yeah.
Here we have Kenji Jojima. His 2006, the most, that's his rookie year, the most games he ever played, 144 games. Yeah. He walked 20 times and he struck out 46 times.
That is insane.
In 542 plate appearances.
That is insane. And he had a pretty decent OPS while doing that as well.
783.
Yeah.
I mean, it was downhill from there, but
yeah,
that's great. The next year, 15 walks, 41 strikeouts.
God. I mean, you know how people always say that baseball games last too long now? I think that probably plays a kind of decent role into it. Guys weren't really striking out, and they weren't really walking. So they were swinging at the first pitch and grounding out a lot of the time.
That's right. They should have all just rolled over to shortstop like Kenji liked to do every time he was at the plate.
Exactly.
And then the final card is the Superstar Special. Today and tomorrow, Red Sox Mo Vaughn hanging out with Cecil Fielder.
Wow, nice. Couple of big fat dudes.
First line on the back, Cecil Fielder returned from Japan to stake his claim as a tower of power at first base for the Tigers. So good. I got this. I was talking about Patrick. He brought me, we met up last week at an event here, and he brought just a brick of cards that he had gotten from the Goodwill in Seattle. And they are all over the place. There's a $3 brick, and they've got basketball, they've got football, they've got everything. And just reading what was on the back of these cards in the 90s was just incredible. I mean, some of these ones that were like, they were like hip hop, you know? It'd be like,
yes.
Especially the basketball ones, you know, they'd say Cedric Sabalos was a cool cat at the line, you know, stuff like that. It's just absolutely incredible to read, like, what was on the back of these things, the little tidbits.
Oh yeah, they were amazing, definitely, especially in like the mid 90s when cards started to kind of go off the rails a little bit.
Yeah, as soon as we hit about 1994, that's when the traditional cards kind of died and we started getting real, you know, kind of Chotsky with all the stuff that was written on the back of these cards.
Yeah, real wacky.
Oh, man, here we have this 89 Tops, and I don't know. These aren't the regular 89 Tops, so I don't know what set they're from. They have cartoons on the back of them.
Not cartoons, but
like comic strips.
Yep. I think those cards, are those cards like a little bit bigger than normal ones?
Yeah, they are.
What are those? Those are, I don't know. But, yeah, those ones are real weird because, like, no one is, like, the correct race in the cartoons.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're real weird.
Oh gosh. I could do a whole show on basketball podcast too. That's for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Any of these guys stick out for you as a 1992 roster that we need to attempt to name? This is going to be really hard. Maybe we should do the Mariners.
Yeah. I could probably do pretty well with the Mariners. I'd be down with the Mariners. Don't do the Red Sox because that'll just embarrass me because I don't know anyone on the 92.
Well, you were still a Mariners guy in 1992.
Exactly. Yeah.
Still a Mariners guy. Okay. I'm not going to look at all. I'm not even bringing it up. 92 Mariners. Omar Vizquel at short.
Yep. Greg Brierley.
Yep. Definitely Greg Brierley. Of course.
Yeah.
Griffey.
Henry Cotto.
Yes, Dave Valley.
Paul O'Neill. No, Paul. That's not his name. What's his name? Crap.
It's not Paul O'Neill.
It's crap.
Now all I can think about is Paul O'Neill.
Is it Peter?
Pete O'Brien.
Pete O'Brien. God damn it.
Thank you.
Yes.
The stupid O apostrophe names.
I know, seriously.
Edgar Martinez, 1992.
Yep. Um, God, who was the?
We got Randy Johnson in '92.
Yeah, Randy Johnson was Eric Hansen.
Mike Jackson.
Mike Schooler.
Yeah, I was wondering about Schooler, if Schooler was still there.
Yeah, I was wondering if was Griffey Senior there in '91 and '92 or '90 and '91.
I think he was gone by '92.
Yeah. How about Kevin Mitchell?
Kevin Mitchell. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Deep pull. We got Billy Swift, maybe.
Yeah, I think so. Probably. What else was in that? Mike Jackson was a good one. I give you props on that. Rich Amaral.
Yep, Amaral had to be on there.
Yep. Who the other?
He
came in '93.
Jay Buhner, of course.
Buhner, obviously. Did I already say, or was Alvin Davis still on that team at that point?
Alvin Davis was gone. I think Alvin Davis, 1991 was his last year.
The 89 to 92 Mariners kind of run into each other because it's all that same uniform.
Yeah. We got Tino Martinez at first base. Tino was definitely there.
And I think, yeah, probably Pete O'Brien was the DH that year. What else in that bullpen?
I'm trying to think of the rotation. We got Randy and we got Eric Hansen.
Yeah.
And also, I said Swift, but actually I think Swift was on the Giants in 92. I think he was,
yeah.
He was gone.
You're right.
I'm iffy on Dave Fleming. I can't decide if that's the right,
yeah,
the
he
right
was.
Year for Dave, yeah, Fleming. Okay.
Because he spanned the blue and yellow into the teal and navy. So I think that might have even been his rookie year in 92. Maybe 91.
Yeah.
Who else were the utility guys?
I don't know. You got Briley and you got Amaral in there. That's pretty good.
The backup catcher that year would have been
Bill Hasselman.
Oh, might have been, yeah.
Could have been Bill Hasselman that year. And
yeah.
Then, other guys that could have been on the bench. How about Brett Boone? First time around for Brett Boone.
Oh yeah, yep, definitely, yep.
That's right about that time too. 92 is tough because it's right before a lot of these guys were there.
Yeah, exactly. 93 would have been probably a little bit easier, but I mean, I think we've named a good amount.
Yeah, I think I'm not going to feel embarrassed about anybody I forgot on the bench at this point.
No.
But the pitching and the bullpen, this is where it gets really tough.
Yeah, that was the one year that
we've only got three people in that rotation right now.
Yeah. Well, possibly Fleming too, right? Or no, Fleming counts.
Yeah, I think Fleming is, well, I don't know.
Fleming, Johnson, Hansen.
I don't think Swift is right. I'm taking Swift back.
Yeah. I'm sure people are kind of like screaming at their iPods or computer screens right now.
Yeah, I agree.
They're also probably cheating.
Yeah, that's definitely true. If they're on their iPods, maybe they're not cheating. Yeah. Rest of the bullpen, man. I don't know, dude.
Schooler might not have been there. That might have been, I don't know. Charlton was never a blue and yellow guy, right? He was always navy
Charlton's
and teal.
Post, I think Charlton was still on the Reds in the early '90s. I'll tap out on the.
All right,
on the bullpen.
Sounds good.
Let's bring it up here. Let's see here.
Ah, Harold Reynolds.
Damn. Oh, Harold Reynolds.
Yeah.
Did we really not say Harold Reynolds? I felt like that was one of the first ones I was going to say.
I thought he was gone by 92. Dave Cochran. God damn it.
Dave Cochran.
Yeah.
Oh, Lance Parrish. That was the backup catcher.
Yeah.
I got Bill Hasselman on the roster for 19 plate appearances. Yeah.
I can't believe we forgot Dan Howitt.
Wow. I can.
I know. That was it. Schooler was there. Good. Russ Swan, Jeff Nelson.
Russ Swan. Brian Fisher.
I do not remember Brian Fisher. Do not remember him.
Yeah. I don't. Calvin Jones. Don't remember him.
Oh.
Dennis Rich, Powell. I do remember Rich DeLucia.
As do I. He had a mustache.
Yep.
Tim Leary, I remember.
Mark Grant, Clay Parker, Jim Acker. I remember Jim Acker.
Yeah, I had a Kerry Woodson rookie card. I know that.
Man, those are some bad, bad players.
Yeah, you could have given me $1 million. I never would have come up with Dennis Powell.
Yeah, no.
I don't know what he looks like. I have no recollection of him. Ooh, being
Lance Parrish?
I know, Lance Parrish. That would have been a deep pull.
That's a super deep pull. I can't think about Lance Parrish on anybody but the Detroit Tigers.
He was on the Angels too, right?
Yeah, he was in the Angels in the early 90s. But to me, Lance Parrish is he's a Tiger forever.
Yeah, definitely.
Man, always fun. Love playing that game. I know that our readers probably are readers, listeners. They're probably like, "Ugh, stop it. Super annoying." And this is just driving them nuts the whole time they're on it. But you know what? It's my podcast, so I'm going to do it.
Fair enough. It's definitely fair enough. Dave Cochran. I haven't thought of Dave Cochran probably since like 1992.
I can't believe you missed Harold Reynolds. There's always one that you miss and you're just like, "Oh, we didn't say him? I thought it was assumed."
Yeah.
For some reason, I wasn't even thinking. I was thinking about all the positions that we missed. And I was like, okay, obviously we have second base. Just, you don't even think about it.
Yeah.
Okay, man. I will let you go. Thanks for coming by again. And thanks to everyone for listening to this edition of the podcast with my guest, Doug Kite. And let's say Edgar Martinez. He was a guest in a manner of speaking.
Yeah, me and Edgar, we're both on this podcast.
You're on a podcast together. You can market this to all your friends and say, "Hey, I was on a podcast with Edgar Martinez."
I will do that, absolutely.
Absolutely should do that. Okay, great. Hey, if you like football, you can give Doug a follow on Twitter. It's at Doug Kied Nesson, Kied, K-Y-E-D.
Nesson, N-E-S-N.
And it's N-E-S-N, yes. Nesson the magazine, as I would say, from the old ESPN the magazine commercials.
Ah, yes.
Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on the flip side. Go Red Sox, and if you hate the Red Sox, go Cardinals, and if you don't care, then just watch it anyways, because it's going to be good baseball. And every time I say I don't care about the World Series and then I don't watch it, I immediately regret it 2 weeks later because I miss baseball tremendously.
Definitely. Go team.
Go team. All right, thanks, Doug.
Yep.